I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. David Dushman joins me now. He's been described a lot of ways, but best is perhaps as a photographer. He's a world traveler, as his assignment work for not-for-profits takes him all over the world. I'll get him to explain what a world and humanitarian photographer does, as well we'll reflect on his work and career. There was a stint at theology school and some years as a comedian. His latest book is The Print and the Process, Taking Compelling Photographs from Vision to Expression. It's published by Peach Pit New Writers. The other books are Photographically Speaking, Within the Frame, Vision Mongers, Vision and Voice, and a series of e-books. Go to daviddushman.com for more information, as well as the details on how to get these books. The ones I've seen are visually stunning, and there's a lot of advice for photogs or not. But you'll be able to get some big picture photography advice, and perhaps we'll share one or two now. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program here in Vancouver today, David Dushman. Mr. Dushman, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
Very well. Thank you.
So before we get into the books and what you do, in reading up on you, I learned that a couple years ago now, I guess, you had injured yourself. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I took a fall in Pisa in Italy a couple years ago and fell off a 30-foot wall and landed onto concrete at the bottom and shattered my feet and cracked my pelvis and kind of put a wrench in my travel plans.
Yeah, no, but you're fine now. You're mobile and all that?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it fine. It's sort of a new normal. I really messed my right foot up, and so I've, you know, I've been through physio and rehab, and it'll never be the same. In fact, when I saw the doctor, you know, they did x-rays, and he said in his broken Italian, he said, you know, you've broken both feet very badly. You'll never walk the same again. You'll always walk with a limp. And then he said, but you'll limp with both feet, so it won't look like a limp. And two years later, I'm still trying to figure out what he meant by that. But yeah, I'm, you know, settling into a new normal. It hasn't stopped me. I mean, I just got back from Kathmandu and Antarctica, and my travels continue. So it's I just hobble around a little, and it's good.
Yeah, so there was a process, though, where you had to relearn to walk. Is that correct?
Yeah. I was staying when the evacuation from Italy happened. I ended up at my family home in Ottawa, where I grew up, and ended up at a place called the Rehab Center, which does a lot of work with returning Canadian soldiers from Afghanistan and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I did a full month residential rehab with folks that, to be honest, most of them were in one or two prosthetics, and really kind of, I mean, I was probably one of the only few people that that had all their limbs there, but it was a fantastic, fantastic experience.
And you never thought throughout all of this that I got to change my lifestyle or what I do?
No, I mean, you know, once in a while you have that voice come in and say, oh my gosh, what happens if? You know, what if, I mean, there were some dark days and days where I thought, you know, I'm never going to be able to walk again. And you know, runs through your head, but I never had that sort of that feeling like it's not going to happen. It was a fleeting thought, and I thought, you know, I'll kind of deal with this when it comes. I think you need to kind of stay positive.
Yeah, I was thinking about that last night when I read that you'd had to learn to walk again. I mean, none of us, all of us learned to walk at one point in our life, early in our life. We don't remember it, right? So we can't, it's just mental as well as physical in terms of coming back, I suppose, right?
Absolutely, and it's a stunning process. I mean, it's what the body is capable of is unbelievable, but I think if you rely on your body entirely without relying on kind of a, you know, your mind and your mental process, I think it would be a lot more difficult. But, you know, I went into the rehab program, and I went in a wheelchair. I was actually using some crutches and that sort of thing, but I didn't have a lot of stamina. And their task over a month was to get me up, get me balancing again, get my, you know, you even forget how your joints are meant to move. You just kind of, you know, you fall into whatever your body can do, which is fine for the short term, but for the long term, you know, if your body gets used to doing what it can do instead of what it's supposed to do, you end up with problems. And so I went in a wheelchair, and a month later, you know, thanks to the folks that worked with me, I walked out. It wasn't pretty, but I walked out and got on a plane and went to Cambodia and Laos and Thailand for a month and, you know, hobbled around, but managed to make it.
Yeah, so since then, you've gathered the material and written this new book, which my understanding is it takes us to Iceland, Kenya, Antarctica, and Venice. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. These books of yours, they've sold quite well, haven't they?
They have. They've sold, much to my shock, they've sold very well.
Yeah. Now, who's the audience for these books? Who buys them?
I'm primarily writing to the international photography community, so I would call my average reader a really enthusiastic amateur, someone who does photography more for the love of it than for a paycheck.
Yeah. And I guess these are the same people that go and listen to your talks and presentations, is that correct?
Yeah, by and large, yeah.
Yeah. Do they come to you with a specific thing that they're interested in or that they want to know from you?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think I've developed an audience that's... I don't focus on gear. You know, photography is one of those things that can be either very artistic or can be very technical.
Yeah.
I think at its best, it combines both elements. But there are people that get into photography purely for the technical, and they're drawn to that. And I'm not their guy. At the top of my blog, it says, gear is good, but vision is better. I'm much more interested in talking about what we see, how we see, and how we can express that in a photograph. So my interest in the technology and the technique of photography really only goes as far as how do we use that to express. So the people that I draw as an audience are people that just want to make beautiful photographs. They want to make photographs that say something. They're less concerned about whether their camera says Nikon or Canon on it.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that I've learned in reading your stuff in the last day or two. Is that we don't need to invest a great deal in terms of our gear. I mean, the camera that's on our phone is just as good, is it?
Well, I wouldn't say just as good, but that really is a question of what your needs are. I mean, if you're a professional working photographer, there are certain things that you need. There are certain things your client thinks they need, and that will dictate your choice of gear. But by and large, I mean, we're using technology now in terms of the digital stuff, even the iPhone camera is just... I mean, it's staggering. The iPhone camera is better than the initial first digital cameras that came out.
Yeah.
And I've published in my books and in magazines and that sort of thing. I've published stuff that's been taken with a $10,000 digital SLR and with my iPhone camera. So in terms of being able to say something, it's a little like, you know, using a top-of-the-line word processor or pulling out a pen and a piece of paper.
And so in terms of having a vision, I mean, that's your goal for us, your goal as well. Even when we're just taking pictures of our friends or our food and posting it on Facebook or Twitter, we still need a vision, do we?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the vision is what drives you. Now, it doesn't have to be some big, you know, good versus evil backstory. It can simply be a question of, you know, I want to show... What do I want to show about this food? Is it a meal that's been presented particularly beautifully, in which case you might want to photograph it beautifully? Or is it a meal that, you know, you ordered it and you expected to get something a lot better and what you got was just total garbage? In which case you may photograph that in a way that kind of highlights what a junky meal it is. So it doesn't have to be some grand artistic vision. Just I've started substituting the word intent. What do you want from your photograph? What do you want it to say? And if there's something that's not part of that photograph, then your choice of how you crop the photograph, how close you get to your subject, what you exclude from the frame, all of those have to do with your vision for the final photograph. So, you know, it doesn't have to be some big, you know, Picasso-esque kind of thing. It can simply be an intent for your photograph that you're aware of and then make deliberate choices to get you there.
Is someone who practices their craft as a photographer, I mean, you make your living off of that, doing that. How do you feel about people, even with their phones now, thinking that they're a photographer too?
Well, I think it's great, to be honest. I mean, photography, since its inception, I mean, maybe the very beginning when, you know, daguerreotypes and that sort of thing were coming out, a little difficult for every man just to get their hands on it, but it's been a very democratic art form, and I love the idea that people can pick it up and without... you know, 10 years of training to mix paint and hold their brushes or learn to sculpt or whatever, the craft is relatively immediately accessible. And so it's an amazing thing to see people pick up these iPhone cameras, especially, and the Instagram movement and that sort of thing, to get this this beautiful democratic art form out there. Now, of course, it means that there's going to be a huge signal-to-noise disparity. There's going to be a lot of junk that's put out there, but that's okay. You know, in and amidst among the junk are some really beautiful photographs, and it doesn't threaten me in the least that someone out there wants to be a photographer and not make any money by it, or make money. I mean, you know, it's art. It's not about competition. It's not about winning. And I think especially in photography, we've kind of created this idea that you're not a real photographer until you're a professional. And yet, you know, for example, in athletics, I mean, it's the non-professional athletes that are the Olympians. And no one would ever look at an Olympian and say, well, you're not a real athlete until you're a professional. And so, you know, there has been that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, you're a world and humanitarian photographer. That's how I described you in the introduction. That's in your bio. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility that there'll be more of you, perhaps, and then that you won't get as much work?
It is possible, and yet at the same time, I think the way that I do things is more important than the fact that I can operate a camera. Mm-hmm. My clients, and I'm only just returning to client work now because of my accident, but my clients don't hire me because I know how to use a camera. That's one of the perks, and of course, if I didn't know how to use a camera, they wouldn't hire me. But there's something more, you know, there's an ability to deal with people. I mean, my 12-year career in comedy gave me an ability to communicate non-verbally to people and to make them laugh and to make them feel comfortable. And as a result, you know, I'm very well traveled, and that's just a function of kind of my biography. I've been traveling since I was a kid. And so when clients hire me, they're hiring me not just because I use a camera in a certain way and I create a certain style of photograph, but because I have respect for the people that I'm photographing, and I treat them with dignity, and that shows in the photograph. And because I make them laugh, and because there's an easygoing kind of look to the photograph because of that relationship. So, no, I'm not worried in the least. In fact, I do what I do because, you know, I want to make the world a better place. I want to change things. And in my doing what I do, I think, contributes to that. So if there are more people out there doing it, then that's great. I'm just thrilled.
Now, some of the nonprofits that you've worked for, you've done some work for World Vision. Is that correct?
Uh huh.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, the photography that you would do in that case for them would be sort of for their campaigns and the sort. Is that correct?
Yeah, my primary project over probably about 6 or 7 years before the accident was working with World Vision. They produce a catalog every year, a Christmas gift catalog, and so you can get onto the catalog and you can purchase, for example, soccer balls for a village in Malawi, or a medical clinic for a village in Nigeria, that sort of thing. And so ultimately it's a fundraising project, and my job is to go and make photographs of these places, these communities, and show not just a medical clinic, but show the impact that the medical clinic has, show, you know, a child with the gift of, you know, a goat or that sort of thing, and the difference that has made, show the joy in their life, show the dignity, show the hope, because I think, you know, most of these humanitarian organizations, what they're trying to communicate is hope. You know, if we didn't feel there was hope, we wouldn't probably donate our money.
Yeah. Now, from the photography of yours that I've seen, you know, it's more than a moment, a person. I mean, it really illuminates their life. It tells people's stories. At the same time, photography can also be exploitative. There's a line between the two, and I'm wondering, how do you not cross it?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I have an answer. You know, it's the kind of thing, I think, that you, doing what you do, you have to keep asking the question. You have to keep looking. You know, I mean, this sounds really introspective, but you have to kind of keep looking into your heart and saying, you know, why am I doing this? Which organizations will I work with and which won't I work with? If there's an organization that I feel is doing work that is exploitive, then I just simply won't join in with that and be a part of it. But in terms of my specific photographs, you know, when I first started, one of the first things the client said were, you know, you're not taking the usual flies around the eyes and distended bellies and showing the poverty. I think that's one way that we can exploit the situation is simply by being untruthful. If you go to Africa, yes, there are, of course, there are scenarios where there are flies around the kids' eyes and there are distended bellies and there's nothing romantic about poverty. But the situation is so much bigger than that. It's they're Africans are creative, amazing, wonderful people. And they laugh in the middle of all of this. I mean, this has become their normal. And to show that situation, to manipulate it so that it only shows the poverty, it only shows the flies around the eyes, I think is misleading and does an injustice to the people that are there. In the same way that making it look too rosy or, you know, photoshopping the poverty out would do.
You mentioned that you spent 12 years as a comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what sort of comedy was that? You said nonverbal. Is that correct?
No, it was very verbal, but I learned a lot of nonverbal communication doing it.
I see.
And facial gestures and that sort of thing. I did a stage show that was usually about an hour to an hour and a half long, kind of variety family show, so seated audiences, where usually for something like a charity, a school, a festival, a community theater, that sort of thing. And so I did magic juggling, improv, stand-up. I did sort of a whole variety show that incorporated a bunch of things.
And then going from there, you went into photography. Is that the timeline, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I have been a photographer. I've been making photographs since I was about 14 years old, but it was about, and I'm terrible with numbers, but it was about 10 years ago now that I sort of decided I wanted to leave comedy and go into photography sort of professional.
And then so the comedy and then the stint in theology school, that's all, I guess, converged and helped you in your career as a photographer, right? I mean, I'm assuming it does.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. I mean, I think as an artist, however you want to define that, I think the things that we create, the way that we see the world and then express that, whether you're painting or you're making photographs or writing, I think that's a reflection of who we are, and all of these influences come to bear on that, whether it's, you know, studying business at business school or, in my case, studying theology, previous careers. All of these things kind of come together to make the person we are. And then, you know, to get back to the conversation about vision, you know, that's our vision is a result of how we see the world, and that's a result of who we become through all these experiences.
Now, is vision having that in terms of your photography, I mean, does that mean bias, or is that because you bring your experiences and I'm assuming your thoughts on situations into your vision? But does that come through in the photograph that you take?
Well, I think we'd be lying if we said it didn't. I think now, bear in mind, I'm not a journalist. I don't do journalistic work. I mean, my stuff is unapologetically subjective.
Right.
I think really the question is, if you're a journalist, can it actually be objective? And do we want it to be objective? Do we, by telling these quote-unquote objective stories, are we losing some humanity? I mean, I would just love to have, you know, a newscaster just even give me hints that they give a damn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't, through the work that I do, I don't, yes, to answer your question, there's a strong bias. There's the bias that comes from meeting these people and having experiences with them, developing relationships with them. And I think if the photograph doesn't show that bias, I think that's a weaker photograph. It's the bias that's going to connect to the person that's looking at that photograph later on, that's going to make them feel something.
And do you think about the audience when you're taking a photograph, say? Do you say to yourself, well, this is how people will react to this when they see this?
Yeah, a little bit. I certainly do when I'm learning my craft, when I'm actually sitting there with the camera to my face and I'm photographing a gentleman in India or Kenya or something, then not usually. Usually I'm thinking about just how do I get this stupid thing in my hands to do what I want it to do. You know, there's flies buzzing around your head. There's a million things you're thinking of. But ultimately, I learn my craft so that I can communicate in, you know, with the photographic language to an audience that's going to feel something, that's going to see something, you know, deeper than just the sort of two-dimensional photograph in front of them. I want to elicit a response, and that's not always, you know, with my humanitarian clients. Obviously, I want that to elicit some kind of action, and that's what the clients hire me for. But for my own work, I want them to see the world in a new way. I want them to feel something different, and so I want an experience to come out of those photographs. I want to look at something out in the world and say, oh my gosh, look at that, and have someone see that photograph and feel something of that wonder or whatever it is that I felt, the emotion or mood in that place.
From what I've read about you, you've managed to be both an artist and an entrepreneur and have done quite well doing either, both. How are you able to do that, to be fulfilled as an artist as well as be comfortable as an entrepreneur? I'm assuming that you are.
I am, actually, and I really enjoy, both. I mean, I look at both as an act of creativity. You know, when we create a business, you're creating something that hasn't existed before, and there's no reason why it has to be done the way that anyone else out there does it. And so I've actually got myself to a point where, my humanitarian work aside, I'm really my own client. I publish books. I publish e-books. We've just begun a magazine for photographers. And so my photography and the stories that come out of my travels and my adventures, all of that goes into feeding these books, which are primarily for the educational, for the photography education market. So to me, there's no disconnect. To me, it's about being creative in one area and then being creative in another area, and because they're so connected, I mean, essentially it's really a question of how can I serve this audience? What can I create for them that's going to be of value to them? And then the rest is finding someone to figure out how to, you know, put it on the internet and make the buttons do the thing that they're meant to do.
Now, having seen so much of the world and having met a great number of people, photographing them and the sort, you must have some idea about what this all means and thoughts on the world and the people. Have you come to any conclusions about life and the sort like that, some existential questions?
Yeah. I don't know that I have. In fact, I think I'm left with a great more questions than answers. But I think the questions are getting more interesting. You know, we talked about, I started all of this, you know, in terms of my formal education. I started with 5 years of theology school, and the best of times, you know, they teach you that the answers are less important than the questions. Other times, of course, it's just about dogma and doctrine, and the questions kind of become irrelevant. I'm not really interested in that pursuit. I'm interested in the questions that we're all asking. And I think things for me are becoming simpler. I think they're a little less well-defined than they once were. You know, I'm still idealistic, but I'm much less dogmatic than I was as a youth. And the more suffering I see, the more beauty I see, the more diversity I see. I also see this thread of kind of commonality. You know, we're all different, we're all the same. I mean, I was, 2 years ago, I was at this village in northern Kenya, and It's a long story, but I'll make it very short. Essentially, for whatever reason, I made some connection there with this tribe of Rendili nomads, and we just hit it off, and they ended up giving me a Rendili name and kind of adopting me. And, you know, this was all, it was a beautiful experience, but it was a kind of felt like an isolated kind of thing until I was lying in the hospital bed back in Ottawa, and I had, you know, one hand in a cast and 2 feet in casts, and all of a sudden, the FedEx guy showed up with this box, and in the box was this note from one of our connections at the village in Kenya, and a Rungu, which is an African, at one time it was a war club, now it's kind of just a stick that the elders carry around, mm-hmm. And this tribe, this village, had heard through these mutual friends that I had fallen and broken my feet. And they had gathered the elders in the village under the thorn tree, and they'd held prayers, and they'd literally taken a day to sort of talk about, you know, what can we do for Akeno, which is my Rendili name. And they sent me this beautiful war club, which really just kind of said, you're one of us, keep fighting, and a short note through my guy there that just said, you know, we're thinking about you and we're praying for you. The fact that the world has become so small and that I am part of, really, truly, in some little way, part of this nomadic village in just the poorest of the poor regions of Africa is astonishing to me, and that I can be a part of that and that we can share, you know, I'm going back in 2 weeks back to the village, and I'll bring a bull with me, and they'll slaughter the bull, and we'll have an all-day barbecue, and I don't speak a lick of this language, and yet I am so excited about the connection with these people. And so, you know, if anything, I think for me, other than sort of these bigger questions, life is becoming more and more about the relationships. You know, it's not about the stuff. It's not about any of these things that preoccupy us. It's really, at the end of the day, the thing that we have in life is relationships with each other. And that I think, is becoming sort of more and more the core of who I am and the reason that I make photographs. The reason that I make photographs, I think, is because of that connection and my desire to share what I see with people, either that I know or don't know.
David, this has been fascinating, and it's an interesting career and life, and I appreciate your time today. Good luck with this new book, and safe travels always.
Thanks very much, Joe.
The website for more, daviddushman.com. The book is called The Print and the Process, Taking Compelling Photographs from Vision to Expression, Peach Pit New Writers. Is its publisher, its author, David Dushman, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.